Thank you, Boris. So it's a pleasure to be here. I've never been here, and I'm having a great time. So I'm going to talk today about a very boring problem. So the problem is the following. Consider spheres that are falling under gravity in a very viscous liquid. So the slower the spheres are falling, the better off they are. And moreover, I'm going to be interested in the limit in which the spheres are as far apart as possible. So this is the problem that I, which if I had brought the experiment with me, you would all promptly fall asleep. So the reason that I'm talking, there are a couple of reasons that I'm talking about this. I decided to talk about this because it seemed like it was, it had the largest overlap with things that were going on here. So for example, Lars was asking me about this question because he's interested in sedimentation in stars, in which he believed, at least, so he claimed that he believed that this limit might be applicable. You're actually the only person who ever said to me that this might be useful for something, so say that. So Boris, so some of this, I don't know where Boris went, but there's Boris. So this work, the work that I'm going to tell you about was, we received a lot of help at various intervals from Boris, so there's something to do with Boris. And also, I guess there's this glass meeting going on here, and there's an interesting problem, which I don't know, there's an interesting sort of theoretical problem in the middle of this that will come up that I won't say a lot about, but that I would really like some help on, which is that one would really like to write the continuum limit of the process that I'm going to talk about. And we believe, and I will try to argue as we get on with it, that the continuum limit has to involve a noise source. But I have no idea how to compute the noise source or to argue that in any other than a hand-waving fashion, which is what I will do today. And it's really important for the understanding of this problem, and so I was hoping that somebody might help somehow. Anyway, so the work that I'm going to talk about is done with two sets of collaborators. So the theoretical part was done, as I said, with Boris and also with Peter Mucha, who is now on the faculty at Georgia Tech. Most of the work was done when Peter was at, when we were both at MIT. And as you will see, the work benefited strongly from a really great collaboration with Dave Waitz's group at Harvard, and you will see why as we go on. So, okay. So this is the problem, as I said. So basically, there are spheres which are falling in a viscous liquid. Each of them are falling downwards. And basically, what we would like to know is, what does the dynamics of this look like? In the limit that the spheres are falling so slowly that there's no inertia, so that if you turned off the forces that are pulling these things down, everything, both the fluid and the particles, would stop instantly. And moreover, in the limit where the particles are infinitely far apart. So there's one. So in that limit, of course, we can solve the problem. That is the limit in which the particles are infinitely far apart. And in that limit, the problem is really this problem, namely a single sphere which is falling. And everybody knows that a single sphere that's falling, if you'd like to compute its dynamics, what you should do is balance the drag force on the sphere, which is given by 6 pi times the viscosity times the radius of the sphere times its velocity with the applied force. And this is Stokes' drag law, which gives you the velocity. So now, it would stand to reason that if the volume fraction of spheres is very, very small but is not zero, that the velocity that the spheres should fall at must be somehow related to this formula, because after all, if the spheres are far apart, then they're far apart. And this sort of question, namely the question of what is the average velocity of particles that are falling in a sediment, is a classical problem in fluid mechanics, and the formula for the average velocity is currently believed to be this. The formula is usually credited to Batchelor, although one can find references earlier, and it basically says that the correction to the Stokes velocity, that is just the falling velocity of a single sphere, goes linearly in the volume fraction, which is not an obvious fact by any means, but one that I don't have time to explain. And this formula is supposed to be true in these limits, which...
There's one more assumption behind that.
Which is?
There's a particular choice of particle distribution.
Oh, right. So this is under the assumption that the particle distribution is randomly distributed, and that question will be central, of course, to this talk. So we will visit that again. Okay. So these are the particles. So what I wanted to say was that the particles, of course, don't all fall down at the average velocity. They're going to jiggle around as they fall. And so how much do they jiggle? So let me just show you an experiment. So this is an experimental trace of particles jiggling in a dilute suspension by Babette Guazzelli's group in Marseille. And this is two particles that are falling. And you can see that they don't fall straight down. This particle sort of meanders to the right and around, and this particle doesn't even fall straight down. It goes up and then jiggles around and then comes down. And basically the question that this talk is going to focus on is to please estimate, to please calculate, not even estimate, how does one calculate the amount of jiggling that occurs?
How do you write down the particle?
Say again?
How do you write down the particle?
These are identical particles. And the particles are small enough such that they are falling with no inertia, which means that in practice, it depends on the viscosity of the liquid that you're working in. And in the experiments that I will describe that were done by Dave Waitz's group, for example, the particles are, say, 10 microns large. But if you were using more viscous fluid, you could use a bigger particle. Okay. So why is it that the particles jiggle? So sorry, this is repetitive. Why is it that the particles jiggle? So let's just consider the case again of a single particle. So a single particle falling, of course, as it's falling, it's pulling fluid down with it. We're working in the viscous limit, remember, which means that momentum diffusion is instantaneous. So a lot of fluid is going to get pulled with it. And one can calculate how much fluid is pulled down with it in the following way. If one simply takes the Navier-Stokes equation, deletes the inertial term, and balances the viscous stress and the pressure gradient against the force that the particle is exerting on the fluid. If one pretends that one is far from the particle, one can approximate that force as just a delta function, and then the velocity field obeys this equation. Now, in three dimensions, you all know the solution to this equation, at least morally. You know that the Laplacian, Laplace's equation in three dimensions has the feature that it decays like, the decay is 1 over r, but the fluid is incompressible, and that's what the pressure gradient is doing. And so for that reason, the solution to this problem is a little more complicated. There's a 1 over r, and then there's an angular dependence, which basically enforces the incompressibility constraint. There are corrections to this formula that are close to that are important if you're close enough to the particle. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to delete these terms completely. They're not going to enter. And a reasonable question that you could ask at some point, and I'm happy to try the best I can to answer, is whether or not that's legal. It's a subtle question, which to some extent is related to the question that I wanted to ask you. Okay, so let me see, is there anything else I wanted to say? Oh, 1 over r is a very slow decay. So just in case you haven't thought about this before, I mean, you know, I'm jumping in front of you and the velocity field around me is, roughly speaking, decaying like 1 over r cubed, which is much faster than 1 over r. If the velocity field around me were decaying like 1 over r, then the people in the back of the room would have about 1/10 the velocity that I do, and so you would all be swaying. And it's that swaying that is the cause of the difficulty of this problem, because everybody is really pulling on everybody, and we want to find out how it works. So, equation of motion. So if you consider the ith particle that's in the suspension, the equation of motion for the particle is this. Oh, by the way, I didn't say this, so let me just make sure I say this. I'm going to name this velocity field S. I don't know why.
Yeah,
yes, please.
If you integrate out the velocity over volume,
yeah. I agree. Okay, so good. So of course, so you're pointing out a very important fact, which is that this equation can't hold everywhere. So in practice, I said that everything that I'm doing is neglecting inertia. And so if you have a single particle that's falling, then, you know, momentum diffusion isn't instantaneous. The distance that momentum diffuses, you know, in the time that the sphere falls its own diameter is some finite distance. We're just assuming that it's very large. And so this formula only works inside of that radius. And outside of that radius, there's something else, so that in practice, the kinetic energy doesn't diverge. Although this is a subtle question, and there are many details that I don't want to or have time to go into. Right, so it's certainly true. I agree. I absolutely agree. Okay, good. Anyway, back to the dynamics. So the equation of motion is this. The velocity of the ith particle, it falls at the Stokes velocity. We're in the low volume fraction limit, so I'm just going to forget this linear and phi term. And then the other thing that happens is that every particle is influenced by the flow field that every other particle sets up. And in the dilute limit, this is correct, at least to leading order in something, that this is the velocity field. So the question of how much the particles are jiggling as they fall is basically the question of how big is this sum. Now, if you think about it, if you're a particle in the middle of the suspension, the sum is going to consist of terms which are both positive and negative, and so the only sensible way to ask what the size of it is to compute the variance. The first people, to my knowledge, that thought to ask the question of what is the variance are Russ Kaflisch and Jonathan Luke, who presented the following calculation in 1985. They said, look, the typical size of this, if we assume, as Bud implied, that the particles are randomly distributed, which is the typical assumption that one makes in this field, then the typical size of the sum is that we should square this and integrate, and of course, the kinetic energy diverges. Well, I mean, this is the integral over the volume of 1 over r squared, so this actually diverges linearly with the system size, and so this says that the velocity fluctuations, that is, the variance, should depend on the size of the box that you're in. And it is this fact which sort of led to a little field, and there have been many of us who have been sort of obsessed with the truth, whether or not this argument is actually true. So before I discuss it in more detail, let me just briefly discuss the physics of what I just said. The physics was exposed best by an argument of John Hinch, who said the following. Suppose that we have some volume fraction phi of particles, and suppose that we draw a circle of radius r, which is enclosing some of the particles. Well, the average number of particles that are in the circle, if the particles are randomly distributed, is just the volume fraction times the size, the volume of the sphere, divided by the volume of the little sphere. But if the particles are randomly distributed, then the variance in that number is going to go like the square root of n. So it's the square root of this number. So that means that this blob is going to be, in general, either heavier or lighter than average. So it will either rise or fall. And so we can therefore ask, how fast will it move? And so this is viscous flow. So the rule of viscous flow is, if you want to find out how fast something moves, you should divide by its mobility, and the mobility scales linearly with r. So that means that the velocity fluctuations, that is, the velocity of this blob relative to the background, should go like the square root of n divided by r, but this goes like the square root of r. It goes like the square root of the size of the blob, and so this again predicts that the velocity fluctuations diverge with system size. So are there any questions? This is the problem. So the problem is basically, is this argument correct? That's the problem that I want to talk about. And there are basically two views on this. There's a diversity of views that exists to this day in the community. Oh, thank you, John. Yes.
If you can imagine a view where the density of particles, the volume fraction of particles, is so low that phi r over a is still small.
Phi r over a, why is that irrelevant?
That's the factor that appears inside the square root there.
You mean phi r cubed over a? Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, fine. Phi r over a. Okay. Yeah, okay. Fine. Yes, phi r over a. It can be still small.
So you could imagine a regime where the system is quite big.
Yeah.
You have some particles, but phi r over a is less than 1.
Yep.
And then you don't have this problem.
Right. So I'm going to get to that. But it is traditional in this field, and I think this is a fair statement, it is traditional in this field to consider the infinite system limit.
I'm wondering whether the random distribution of particles is a good assumption, because I would sort of expect them to get clumped together.
Right. No, this is an excellent question, and I will come back to this. So let me just leave it for the moment. So at the moment, maybe I'll tell you what I think. So I believe that I am going to present evidence to you that it is an extremely good assumption. However, I agree also that it is unclear. On the other hand, let me just also say this, which is that this argument is really a simple argument. So, I mean, even if the statistics aren't Poisson, I mean, if they're morally Poisson, if you allow me to say, then you're going to have this problem. I mean, it's very hard to find a particle distribution which avoids this. The numerator is basically Poisson statistics, the denominator is basically that you're in Stokes flow, and so if you're going to avoid this, those are your two options, basically. At least looking at this crudely. So it's really a good argument, this argument. So anyway, there are two views on this argument, and I think that this is still true, and it certainly has been true with people feeling very passionately about both sides in the community about this argument. And basically the two arguments are, there are people who believe the argument and there are those that don't. The people who don't believe the argument basically say that, look, there's no way that the velocity fluctuations can depend on the system size, and we know of other physical problems in which such divergences exist, you know, like Coulombic, you know, screening, Debye-Huckel screening, and maybe there's some screening effect, some screening mechanism that exists that will cut off the velocity fluctuations. And so then, you know, from this point of view, the central question in the field is to find the screening mechanism. The second, point of view is basically that the arguments are right, and that diffusion in a sediment is qualitatively different than normal diffusion, and that the velocity fluctuations depend on system size. So what do experiments say? So shortly after these arguments were proposed in the mid-80s, experiments started to be done. This is just a photograph from a recent paper by Panger Tong and Bruce Ackerson's group in Oklahoma, which shows the tracks of sedimenting particle. But so let me now show you.
I'm sorry, I don't know what I saw on that figure.
So these are just sort of, this is a movie of particle tracks.
Yeah, I mean, what is a particle on there? A white spot?
A white spot, and they're moving. They took just a continuous image of the particles going. It's just supposed to show.
Why do they have vortices?
Oh, we're going to get to that.
I mean, they're just falling under gravity.
They're just falling under gravity. Vortices can form in viscous flows. We'll get to that. Those are the velocity fluctuations, right? In fact, those are the velocity fluctuations. So you've now.
There's one thing that I may be naive, but one thing that bothers me about the whole problem, it seems to me that there must be different regimes depending on how well the particle of the density is matched to that of the fluid.
But remember that if the particle density is exactly matched to that of the fluid, the particles won't fall, and right. It is the difference in density that leads to the force.
And if the match is not perfect, but it's off a little bit, then you will get small velocities, and presumably has small Reynolds numbers involved, and there will be laminar flow around the particle.
Everything that I'm talking about is in the zero Reynolds number limit. The theoretical problem that I'm going to consider is the zero Reynolds number limit, and there is, in fact, laminar flow around all the particles. There's no inertia of the fluid in any of this. And in particular, in this experiment, if one estimates the largest Reynolds number in this experiment, it's still very small. I don't remember the numbers, but it's still much less than one. Even if you take it on, using the size of the cell. Well, in the size of the particle, it's 10 to the minus 4, for example, is a number. I mean, but nonetheless, there are swirls, and as John correctly points out, these are the velocity fluctuations. It's because there are lighter regions that are lighter than average, they will rise, and if it occurs coherently, then you will tend to see swirls. So swirls. This is a piece of a much bigger. I'm going to show you a much bigger one. This was actually just an introductory slide. Yeah, we're going to get to that. Good. So I'm just going to try to summarize for you the history of this problem as I know it. Actually, in fact, Bud, it's good that Bud is here because he can correct me. Because in fact, he was, to my knowledge, the first person to actually measure the velocity fluctuations. It's true, right?
You're the first people to think
of that. Right. So, so in any case, experiments have, up until basically 2001, to my knowledge, have always reported that the argument is wrong and that the velocity fluctuations are independent of the system size. And there were various incarnations of the experiments that have occurred, sort of as a function of time with increasing sophistication. The first experiments were done by Budd, and then they were followed up by Nicolai and Guazzelli, who basically just did particle tracking. They just looked, in fact, these were the traces that I showed you a while ago. Just look at them, study the statistics of the traces, and do it for different system sizes and deduce, how the velocity fluctuations depend on system size. So this was the sort of first class of experiments, and none of them saw any dependence on the system size at all, indicating that there must be something else going on. So in 97, there was a paper which actually was the paper that got me interested in this problem. It's more or less true that as soon as I read this paper, I decided, oh, well, I dropped everything and started working on this problem. And so the paper that got me interested, as I said, was by Segre, Herbolzheimer, and Chaikin, who used PIV, so particle image velocimetry, to just track the velocity field of the particles in the falling cell. And I will show you some of those results in a minute. This was followed up recently by Babette Guazzelli, who did this in slightly larger cells. And then there's also an experiment recently, which I will show you in a second, by Lei Tong and Ackerson, who actually directly measured the density fluctuations. They actually counted the number density fluctuations in the cell. And all of these concluded that velocity fluctuations were independent of system size. So let me just show you, just as a sample of these, I don't have time to go through all of it, obviously, are the Segre, Herbolzheimer, and Chaikin experiments. So basically what they did was to use PIV to image the velocity field in the cell, and you see swirls. So these are this is the velocity of the particles relative to the falling velocity, and it naturally falls into swirls, and this is basically, these are two different volume fractions, so that the size of the swirl and the size of the arrows in the swirl changes as you change the volume fraction. And basically, they did this systematically as a function of volume fraction over quite a large range. And what they found was the following. So this is a summary of the data. When you plot the velocity fluctuations as a function of volume fraction on a log-log plot, these are the two components of the velocity fluctuations that they measured, which were in the parallel to the direction of gravity and perpendicular to the direction of gravity. They found that over what looks like four decades, the velocity fluctuations up to very you know, down to very small volume fractions, scale like volume fraction to the 1/3 power. And moreover, there's a correlation length which they measured, although I'm not showing you the data, which suggested that the correlation length should scale like the velocity fluctuation to the -1/3 power. And the striking thing about this power is that if you recall back to the previous slides, the volume fraction appeared inside of a square root. So according to the simple argument, it should go like the 1/2 power. So this contradicts that over a large number of decades. So in addition to this, they presented the following plot, which is that if you normalize the velocity fluctuations to this value, this, you know, phi to the 1/3 law, and you also normalize the width of the cell to the correlation length, which is supposed to go like phi to the -1/3, then as a function of cell size, the thing seemed to hit a plateau. So this is a picture. So on this plot are data of many different cell size experiments that they did, and then also in the inset to this plot listed all other work that had ever been done on the problem up to that point. And all of the data were supposed to be falling on this curve, and so therefore it was argued that the fluctuations were universal and independent of system size. So I basically dropped everything because being a, you know, I mean, as a theorist, you know, if you're willing to work on problems in the low volume fraction limit, it doesn't get any better than this. You know, if the exponent is wrong, it's supposed to be universal, and so if you're willing to do it, then, you know, this is how I argued to myself, this is what you should be doing. So there it is. So there's one other experiment I want to show you, because this was really, I think, a great experiment that was done very recently by Panger Tong and Bruce Ackerson in Oklahoma. So they actually measured the number density fluctuations as a function of in the system. And they did this by simply counting. They took spherical regions and they counted the number of particles in it, and then they measured the variance. They calculated the variance as a function of the size of the number of particles in this. So you can see this is the variance as a function of n, and the variance scales linearly with n initially. This is at time equals zero. And then as time evolved, they saw that this distribution changed, which is showing you dynamically that the Poisson statistics part of the numerator of the argument, something is changing. And this is an extremely time-consuming thing to do, and it really took a lot of patients, and they saw something interesting. So I wanted to show you that. Okay. So good. So then we're at theories and simulations. So I think that the following is accurate, which is that it is generally true that all theories that were written down of this problem were theories to find screening mechanisms. So they all predicted essentially by construction that the velocity fluctuations didn't depend on system size. And there were two of these that occurred in the 90s. But as far as simulations were going on, there were a set of simulations that were sort of started by Tony Ladd, continued by Don Koch, which basically always concluded that they were simulations in a periodic box with relatively small numbers of particles compared to the experiments, so 30,000 particles compared to the experiments or so, of many, many more than that. But these always concluded that there was no screening and that the velocity fluctuations increased the system size. So basically what I'm trying to say is that the situation was a mess. The sort of qualitative theory predicted that they diverged, the detailed theories or the detailed constructions predicted screening, and the simulations all predicted no screening. And so the question was, and the experiments gave a universal law which went like phi to the 1/3. And so the question is, and this is what I want to try. Yeah. Right. Good. So this was the argument. So at the time, I think what would have, what they would have said was, well, look, we don't have enough particles yet, because, I mean, of course, the correlation length wasn't known at that time, but it was clear that it was far fewer than the number of particles that were in the experiments, and the concern was that, you know, there was no screening, but on the other hand, it was a relatively small system, and so perhaps that's the reason. So that's, you're absolutely right again. So okay. So now, I've now explained to you the dilemma. And what I want to do for the rest of the talk is try to explain to you what we believe is going on. And actually, when I first wrote this the other day, I thought that I would tell you about something else at the end, but there's not going to be time, so I'm not going to do that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about all the issues that you've already brought up, I think. I'm going to tell you about what happens, just thinking a little bit about finite cells and what they do. I'm going to tell you about some experiments that Dave Waitz's group did in very wide cells, and then try to explain to you what we think is going on, and see if you... try to convince you as best as I can. So okay. So the comment is that all theories and simulations have assumed that the system is both infinite and homogeneous. And homogeneous is that the distribution is random. Whatever your views on this, then as John said a while ago, the experiments are definitely not infinite. And in particular, the experiments tend to be done in geometries which have the following characteristics. So the cell has some depth, which is called D. There's a width, W, and a height, H. D is perpendicular to the imaging direction, so you're looking onto the imaging direction in this way. And D has to be small, because at least when measured in particle, in units of particle size, because otherwise you can't see through the cell, in which case you can't do the experiment in the first place. So there's a, it was before 2000, I think this is right, before 2000, all cells had D over A less than 100. So what happens? So, and in fact, actually, just to comment on this plot. So, if you in this plot, actually, there's the cell depth and there's the width. This axis is actually measuring the width of the cell, in units of the correlation length. But the depth is fixed to be about 100 because otherwise you can't see through the cell. So, what do walls do? So, and actually, right, here's a picture of the depth. These lines are the cell depth on top of the swirls. And so you can see, actually, that the cell depth is of order the size of the swirls in these pictures, which is sort of indicating that the cell depth must have something to do with this. So now, what do walls do? So just a simple argument about the effect of walls in a viscous flow. So I've already argued that if you have a particle that is falling, the velocity field around the particle decays like 1 over r. Well, the problem, I've already also said, is sort of morally like electrostatics. And in electrostatics, you know that the way that you're supposed to satisfy boundary conditions on walls is to use images. Well, the same is true with viscous flow. It's a little more complicated, and I'm simplifying slightly. But roughly, what you have to do if you want to satisfy no slip conditions on the wall is to put an image particle with a force which is opposite to that of the original particle on the other side. And the consequence of that, as you can see immediately, just like in electrostatics, is that the velocity field decays like 1 over r close to the particle, but far enough away from the particle, it decays like 1 over r squared. The integral of 1 over r squared squared is integrable, which basically implies that in a real experiment, the integral that I was, and you already said this too, talk is catching up to you, which is this, which is that the integral is convergent. So in a real experiment, there is actually no divergence problem. So for this reason, we decided, just this is completely brute force and this is sort of stupid, but we decided to do the integral. It's a terrible integral to do, but we decided that the advantage of doing the integral is that then you have a baseline through which you can measure things. And so here is the integral. It's a terrible integral. So this is the velocity fluctuations. This is the same integral that I already presented before. But now the reason that it's a terrible integral is because u here is going to be the velocity field of a particle falling in the experimental cell in question. And this is a nightmare. But it turns out that, but so sort of you know something about it before you start, which is that this integral has to have the property that the velocity fluctuation squared, that the characteristic length scale which cuts off the integral is the cell depth, because it's the closest wall that a particle is near that actually matters, and there's going to be some prefactor that is geometry dependent. So this argument would predict that for a finite cell, the correlation length should be set by the cell depth. It should be about half the cell depth. So the question is how does this argument compare to experiments? And it's a terrible integral, but Peter Mucha is really very energetic and very, very good. And he did the integrals. I mean, and these are the results of his integrals, which I will just present to you like this. This is the data that I showed you before that has this phi to the 1/3 scaling. This is the velocity fluctuations as a function of volume fraction. And these lines are the results of the integrals in the cells that they used. And so this is the parallel fluctuations and the perpendicular fluctuations. And what I want you to notice is, the important thing to notice from this plot is that down at low volume fractions, actually, you're not so far off. It's very close. At high volume fractions, there is a discrepancy which is about a factor of 2. So basically, the statement is that the problem that we're discussing is a problem that involves factors of 2s. It's not an order of magnitude thing. This is a detailed measurement thing. And that is really an important observation in trying to figure out what is going on. Yeah. Well, actually, in fact, I'm going to end up sort of agreeing with that. I'm not going to completely agree for reasons that you will see, but I'm going to end up sort of agreeing with that. So, okay. So basically, now on the other hand, there is a discrepancy with the experiments of this factor of 2, and so what is going on? So a natural thing to think of is basically what has now been brought up several times, which is maybe the particle distribution is not random. So the only way that I know of testing that is to do a simulation. And so we did a simulation in which we simply put large numbers of particles between two parallel walls and let them fall, making it with periodic copies on the top, periodic in both other directions. We also did them, as I will tell you in a little while, not periodic in the vertical. But basically, and we the number of particles that we used, that we developed algorithms which allowed us to do up to on the order of a million particles, which was enough that the correlation length was of order, was in the range of the experiment. So there wasn't the number problem. And what happened in these was the following. Well, first, actually, these are velocity fields. So this is a PIV picture of the velocity field from an experiment and a simulation under the same conditions. And this is just a design to convince you that the velocity fields that are being computed are realistic, so that swirls do exist in viscous flows in the way that you see. But this is the important plot. Which is that if you start the particles on a lattice, or however you want, just start the particles in some non-random configuration and you let it go, these dotted lines are the predictions from the Poisson distribution. So these are the predictions from assuming that the particles are randomly distributed. And what you see is that the velocity fluctuations very quickly, in about the time that it takes for a particle to fall 10 diameters, relaxes to the values that are consistent with the particles being Poisson distributed. And this is true independently of the way that you set it up initially. We were unable to violate this. So these three curves, this is the vertical, this is the fluctuations down side, this direction and this direction. So this is the perpendicular to the wall, and this is the ratio is about 2:1 and 3:1. The 2:1, both are consistent with experiments. So so moreover, if you measure anything in these simulations about the particle velocity distribution, it always agrees with the predictions from the Poisson statistics. So these are measurements of the velocity fluctuations across the cell thickness. And you can see that the velocity fluctuations depend on how far you are from the wall. And basically, it's dead on. These are single realizations that are being plotted here. If you average, then it's absolutely on. There's no error at all to what we can see. So we were actually very disappointed by this, because we were hoping that something would happen to the particle distribution which would solve the problem. And there's still this factor of two discrepancy that I mentioned before. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit about some more experiments. So in the meantime, Dave Waitz's group was doing experiments to increase the cell depth, basically by using various imaging methods. So they used two different methods to do this. One was PIV, using 25 micron sized particles, and they also did the experiments with light scattering using even smaller particles, and they were able to do cell sizes which were about a factor of 10 larger than those that had been measured previously when measured in units of the particle size. And so they were doing the experiments at large. So if what I'm telling you is correct, then the velocity fluctuations should increase. So at this point, there's good news and bad news. So at least from my point of view, the good news is that the velocity fluctuations did increase. However, the bad news is that this is what the data looked like. So this is data for the velocity fluctuations as a function of time. And what you will notice, this is the whole experiment that is being plotted. And these are different conditions, basically. These two lines down below are the conditions for the cells of thicknesses and the thicknesses that have been measured before. And what you can see is that the velocity fluctuations are basically constant in time to the end of the experiment. The experiment ends because there's a sediment front which eventually runs into the imaging window and ends the experiment. But everything else has the property that the velocity fluctuations are larger than they were before. However, they decay continuously in time. Dave's group then did tried to collapse the data. And what they noticed was that if they measured time in units of the time that it takes for the sediment front to fall through the whole cell, that all the data collapsed on top of each other. Which is a complete disaster from the point. I mean, during the time they were doing this, I continually insisted that this was impossible, that there was no way that the cell height could enter into the problem. And the reason that I said that was because, look, where did the cell height enter in anything that I've told you before? I mean, hydrodynamically, who cares about the height? But nonetheless, this tells you that the cell height is an important parameter. And so there it is. So we were all very, very puzzled about this, and the simulations wouldn't do this, no matter how hard we pushed them. And we tried everything that we could think of. We thought about polydispersity, because of course experiments aren't monodispersed. There's a 10% or so polydispersity in the velocities of the different particles owing to different densities and sizes. We thought about inertial effects, boycott, the cell might not be straight. Thermal convection. Turns out that if you ask yourself the following question, there are temperature gradients across the cell. If you ask what is the temperature gradient across the cell, the temperature difference across the two boundaries of the cell, where there will be a difference in the size of the fluctuations, it turns out to be millikelvinish. And so we thought, we've got it. But of course, the experiments were done in a cooled bath, and there was just no way. It didn't work. And so nothing worked. And so we then, this is the drama part of the talk, we then basically, literally, all of us sat around the table looking at the data for days. I mean, this was just raw data as a function of radius, volume fraction, viscosity, cell depth. And we were just trying to figure out the following simple question. Some cells had the property that the velocity fluctuations were constant in time, and some had them decay. And we just wanted to know what parameter was controlling this difference. And so we just sat around staring at the data. And we really were very puzzled for quite a while, until one day, literally the day before Peter, it was 2 days before Peter was about to leave for Georgia Tech, he walked into my office and told me the following thing. He said, I know the parameter. He said, the parameter that's important is the size of the velocity fluctuations relative to the falling velocity of a single particle. To which I said, that's impossible. Because the reason I said it was impossible was because obviously if you fall in a frame moving with the particles, I mean, this velocity didn't enter anywhere in the problem that I just described. So if you fall in a frame that's going with the particles, then it can't possibly matter. But he said, no, because remember, there's a sediment front at the top of this thing. And the sediment front, as a function of time, of course, is going to spread. And so because of that, even though the imaging window and the experiments are down here, you are going to develop a very, very small stratification in the imaging window. It's going to be very, very small because the experiments are designed to get away from that. But there is going to be one, and the size of the stratification is going to increase with cell depth. And so in order to convince me of this, he then presented me with the following two simulations. Of course, you can do this in the computer. I mean, in the computer, it basically just relies putting the bottom on the cell. If you plot the velocity fluctuations into the same plot I showed you as a function of time, when delta u over u is less than 1, then basically it's always consistent with the Poisson statistics. That is, but if you do it with this parameter bigger than 1, then all of a sudden what you see is this, that the velocity fluctuations decay continuously in time. These are the three components, and it's reminiscent of the experiments. And in fact, if you were being observant, you will have noticed that on this plot with the scaled data, there were simulation dots, which are different conditions of simulations of this sort. So this is a good thing, because the one good thing about computers is that if they do this, they know what the answer is. So we just had to find out what the answer is from the computer. And after head scratching, came up with the following mechanism. So let me just recall, and I'm just going to tell it to you in simple terms, and then I'll tell you the things that we're confused about in terms of more general formulations. So in simple terms, basically, remember this blob argument. So we had a blob of size R, and there were particles inside of it. And what I said was that basically there is the volume fraction inside of this blob is going to be bigger than or smaller than the average by an amount which depends on the square root of the number of particles in the flow. And for that reason, the blob will fall faster or slower than average in accordance with the formula that I presented. And so the question is how does this argument change if there's a stratification? And this is sort of easy to think about. If you realize that if there is a stratification, then the stratification will of course be a stable one, so there will be more particles at the bottom than there are at the top. So suppose that the stratification, the volume fraction decreases with increasing z over a length scale whose inverse is called beta, then if the change in volume fraction in this blob due to the stratification is larger than the change due to the fluctuations, the game is over. Nothing will happen. Right? Because, you know, the system of stratification, it's stable, right? So density fluctuations want to relax to the stable stratification. And so basically, if you write this in formulas, what this says is that if R, the size of the blob, is bigger than delta phi, where delta phi is the change in volume fraction due to the Poisson statistics, divided by beta phi, just from this formula, then the density fluctuations are suppressed. This is a qualitative argument. I'll give you a more quantitative one in a moment. But now you see, I've already told you delta phi is equal to this, and so now you see we can solve for R. Right? You can solve for the size of the blob, the size of the thing at which the density fluctuations are suppressed. And when you do this, what you find is the following. That is that the critical size of the size of the largest fluctuations scales like phi to the minus 1/5 with the prefactor, which is stratification dependent, and the velocity fluctuations go like volume fraction to the 2/5. So whatever. But the interesting fact, at least to us, was that it also implies that there's a critical stratification. Because if this length scale that just existed, that I just argued, is bigger than the cell depth, when you're bigger than the cell depth, then you don't, I mean, then you no longer feel hydrodynamics. And so basically you're back in the other regime. Because remember, if the fluctuations are bigger than the cell depth, then just according to Poisson statistics, there should be no divergence. So nothing is going to happen. So if you set R star equal to D, you can derive the critical stratification for this effect to set in. And so this is the critical stratification. This is the inverse length over which the stratification is measured in units of the cell depth. And basically, it turns out that this goes like 1 over the square root of the number of particles in a sphere of order the cell depth. And if you put in numbers for this, for the experiments, this number turns out to be 10 to the minus 4. So that means that the stratification length scale that you need to screw up this beautiful experiment that I was describing is if there's a stratification whose length, the volume fraction is varying over a scale which is 10 to the 4, 10 to the 3, 1,000 times the cell depth, then you're in trouble. But that means you need a very high cell, and when the cell gets big, you no longer have that. So this is the germ of the idea. And we basically, since then, just tested the idea in every way we could think of. And I'll just show you some of them. So the simulations show a critical stratification. If you, in the simulations, plot the velocity fluctuations as a function of the stratification length scale measured in units of the critical value, then what you see is this. This is the Poisson prediction, this line. And what you see is that for low stratifications, the fluctuations are basically constant, and then they start to decrease for higher stratifications, so that there's critical stratification exists in the simulations. So now, actually, let me just take a 3-minute aside and tell you a theoretical issue which we're confused about. So this is where all the glass people have to wake up, because we need to know how to think about this. So, of course, everything that I've told you is heuristic, and so we wanted to do a better calculation. And so let me just describe the better calculation that we tried to do and then tell you where we're confused. So the particle dynamics I already told you, every particle moves with a velocity which is basically given by the other particle. One needs to write down what we really need, and in a certain sense the whole point of this is to find a continuum model. And so the continuum model has to consist of an equation for the volume fraction and an equation for the velocity field. So the equation for the volume fraction has to basically be this, we argue, that there's got to be an average velocity. So there's conservation of volume with an average velocity. And then, there's a flux from the average velocity. There's a flux from diffusion, which is controlled by the velocity fluctuation. So this is the sort of large-scale fluctuations that we've been talking about. And then we argue there has to be a noise source. The noise source, we argue, because this is the point where I don't exactly know how to proceed on a purely theoretical, from a purely theoretical point of view. We argue it's sort of from the short wavelength. I mean, if you look at the sum, right, there's going to be a long wavelength part and there's going to be a short wavelength, and you should be able to separate them, and this should sort of be the short wavelength part. And so this was the thing that we modeled. And we modeled it by basically just saying that it's white noise. Let's assume that it's white noise with some strength. The velocity field we just said is given by the average, the integral that solves Stokes equations. Right. So this is the average velocity field. So this formula is okay. The diffusion constant is supposed to be delta V times the correlation length. The noise source we just took to be white noise. And if you do this, you can sort of do a self-consistent calculation to calculate delta V and L. And what you find is exactly the formulas that I just showed you with all of the scaling laws in them. And you also get formulas for the structure factor, for how the number density depends on wave vector and things like this, which we've tested, and I'll show you a test in a little while. However, when we wrote this down, people who I trust very much got angry at us and said there shouldn't be any noise source in the model. And
can I just ask a question? Maybe you're going to talk about it, but another way to go after this, I would think, would be to do something like you do to get Stokes.
Right, but there's no fluctuation dissipation theorem. This is the problem. Right.
Isn't that what you're putting in the short wave?
Right, this is why I got in trouble.
Okay.
This is precisely why I got in trouble. I mean, people said things like, there's a Lyapunov function, right? The potential energy is uniformly decreasing. Who are you to put in noise? I believe there's noise, and I will show you some evidence for it from experiments, but I don't, anyway, so including noise or not including it is important. So if you don't put in noise, then basically what you're assuming is that the noise in the experiment, of which there certainly is, because otherwise I wouldn't have had a talk, would must come from the initial conditions. I mean, it is possible, right? You're doing this mixing of the cells. So it is possible the noise would come from initial conditions. However, if you don't put noise in, then it turns out that if you do the calculation with a constant stratification in the background, then the velocity fluctuations, it turns out, would decay continuously in time and would never, even with just a constant stratification. And actually, this argument, I forgot to say, it was on one of these slides, and I don't know where it went, was an argument which was made by Luke a year before we started thinking about this, and at the time we knew that he said this, but we didn't see its relevance until much later. So we were preceded slightly in this way of thinking. But he had a constant stratification and no noise, and so the velocity fluctuations decayed continuously. And then, as I just said, but we have no fluctuation dissipation theorem to say that there is noise. So So let me just show you experiments which I think definitively show that there is a noise source. So because I think this is probably, if you're going to be skeptical, this is the best way to address this. So I won't even show you simulations. So basically what we decided to do, just to show that there had to be a noise source in the equation, was to impose an external gradient in the cell, an external density gradient. And you can do this easily just by putting salt, you know, putting some concentration of salt in the cell, and then start out with a particle distribution and let them decay and see what happens. And either, you know, there are two options, right? Either the thing will decay continuously, you know, or it won't. And so Shang Ti did this experiment, and these are his results. So this is the velocity fluctuations as a function of time for three different stratifications, no stratification, or what we call no stratification, you know, and then these two inverse length scales. And you can see clearly that the velocity fluctuations are not only suppressed, but they're constant in time. And if you do the argument without a noise source, you find that the decay time would bring over the time that I've showed you, it would bring this down by a factor of 5. So this is significant. You know, this basically shows that the effective theory has to have a noise source in it. And my question actually for you, which is actually the real motivation I decided to talk about this today, because I somehow had, Boris told me that you, the glass community was thinking about such questions too. I would really know how to, like, you know, how to argue this in a logical way, and I just don't. So, this is also another plot. This is sort of nonsense, but I'll show it to you anyway, which is that, of course, if you can control the stratification, you'll remember that the formula for the velocity fluctuations had a dependence on the stratification, and you can try to test that. And we don't have a lot of data, but it's not inconsistent. So then, I want to end early. I don't want to take up all of the time. We did various types of experimental tests. I'll just show you two of them in detail. I mean, one is that you can look for a stratification in the cell, and that was happening, that was growing, you know, as sort of it was predicted. And that is easily done by just shining light through the cell and measuring the volume fraction. This shows the volume fraction as a function of time that is developing in the cell. This is the initial volume fraction, and as a function of time, you see that a stratification is developing. The imaging window is somewhere down here. These curves are actually the result of a theoretical calculation in which you just take the measured diffusion constant and you solve an advection diffusion equation. And there are no free parameters in this fit. So one can also see this behavior in simulations, the stratification developing. And basically, I don't want to subject you to too many details that you don't care about, but when you put in all the numbers and you really try to question this, it all is consistent. That is to say that the size of the stratifications that are occurring in the simulations are exactly what you would need according to the arguments that I gave to explain the suppression of the fluctuations, and we can't find any disagreement between the two. So let me actually show you number three. So I'm going to skip number two, the suppression of number density fluctuations. So remember this data, which I very much like. This is the measurement by Tong and Ackerson of the number fluctuations as a function of n, which showed that there was some time dependence. So one can, of course, do this in the simulations as well. And this is what you get from the simulations. This is, qualitatively it looks exactly the same. The simulations are doing the same thing. The dotted lines that are going through the data are the results from the calculation of this quantity from the continuum model that I showed you. There are assumptions in the calculation, like the correlations and the noise source, but there are no free parameters, and it seems to agree very well with simulations. So finally, let me just mention the phi to the 1/3 law, and then I will stop. You might wonder, we no longer have a phi to the 1/3 law. We have two laws. One is a phi to the 1/2 law, and one is a phi to the 2/5 law. But the phi to the 2/5 law has a stratification in front of it, which is changing in time. So that's not really a good law either. So what are we going to do about that? And this is the part of my talk which I think is the most controversial. This is my own opinion, and until shown otherwise, then this is what I believe. So you can actually take all of the old data that was done by all of the different groups, and you know their observed values of the velocity fluctuations and the parameters of their cell, and you can calculate, because you know how much the sediment front is spreading, because you know the diffusion constant, you can calculate at what time during the experiment would the stratification exceed the critical value. And when you do that, this is the critical time, that time in units of the time of the experiment, that is the time the data was collected for, and what you see is that these numbers are all less than one. So for that reason, this is indirect, and it, you know, it isn't crazy to say that stratification is somehow contaminating the measurements. Peter also did the following thing, which you can take as you want. This is the plot of the velocity fluctuations as a function of volume fraction from before, and the squares are the data. The squares are the data that I showed you, which fit the phi to the 1/3. This is the phi to the 1/2 law, which came from our calculation. And he just asked, suppose that we impose stratifications which have these two values, beta d is equal to 1/100th and 1/20th. Neither of these two, you would not see either of these two. They're very, very small stratifications. And if you then use the results of the calculations that I've talked about, what you get are the pluses and the squares and the stars, which are actually pretty close to the squares. So it's not an inconsistent, this is not an inconsistent interpretation of the data, although it's not a very elegant interpretation of the data. Because the parameters of these experiments are changing. And remember, the numbers that I told you really depend on the height of the cell. They depend on everything. And so they all come in, and the experiments are all not at the same. I mean, I don't want to draw any conclusions from this data because it's just a suggestion. So, okay, so this is a summary, and then I will shut up. So the summary is that what I believe in, what we believe, is that the velocity fluctuations in sedimentation are highly non-universal. They depend on both the dimension of the container and small inhomogeneities in the system in a critical way. The major lesson that I learned from this entire story is that the problem with velocity fluctuations and the problem with studying them, maybe the reason that I should have not gotten into this in the first place, is because they're really very sensitive to small physical effects. And the reason for that is just the following, that the velocity fluctuations are, by their very nature, driven by number density fluctuations, which scale like square root of volume. Whereas any small physical effect, which you might like, which is your friend, be it thermal convection, stratification, scales like the volume. So basically what that says is that the critical parameter for any effect that you're interested in is going to be very, very small, and so you better be damn careful when you're doing the experiments. And this, I don't know if this is, well, I think this is true. I don't know what else to say about it. Finally, the diffusivity of the sediment. So one result which came out of this work, which might be the only useful result, if it's even useful, if it's true, which we think it's true, is a formula for the diffusivity of the sediment. And basically, the formula that one gets for the diffusivity of a sediment is the following. When the stratification is lower than this critical stratification, the diffusivity is set by the cell size. But when it's above the critical stratification, the diffusivity depends both on the volume fraction and on vertical derivatives of the volume fraction in this way. We tested this the best we could in the simulations by studying the spreading of the sediment front. And all I can tell you is that this model worked much better in describing the simulation data than the model where you assume the diffusivity is independent of the gradient. So there seems to be some evidence for it. On the other hand, well, that's the story. So thank you for your attention.
Tom? It seems like, oversimplified a lot of what you just said, it seems like, in essence, you're coming down the side of saying that the fluctuations are cut off by, quote, system size.
Yeah.
And the visualization is the system size can also be set by something like the
stratification. Yeah. Yeah.
Those are being maxed out when they're in the system to study things off.
Yeah.
So what's one of those theoretical calculations that say there should be a finite screening
rate? Well, I mean, the theoretical calculations that say that there should be a finite screening rate have to make assumptions. Like, for example, one of the ideas, which is a very reasonable idea, is to ask, is there a particle distribution, you know, in which you sort of don't get the square root of n divergence? And in fact, there is a class of particle distributions which gets around this effect, which was found. But, you know, in order for this to be, I forgot. There's some deficit, there's a local deficit of particles, Bud probably knows, but there's a local deficit of particles in the vicinity of a single particle. I mean, you know, it's just, you simply have this integral, right, that you have to do, and you put in a structure factor, a G of R, and then you ask, what does the G of R have to look like so that this is convergent? And you can ask that and find out what it has to look like, and there is such a G of R, but of course, the problem with this is that distribution has to be stable. And, you know, I don't know, I mean, according to the simulations and everything that is meant, it doesn't seem to be stable. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis. So the other paper actually that predicted, a finite screening length in the homogeneous system started from the continuum, a set of continuum equations. There's a renormalization argument that started with a set of continuum equations, which is like the one which I've been trying to ask for help on, in which there was a noise source, and made certain assumptions about, the strength of the noise and the size of the diffusion constant, which they did a renormalization argument and they found a regime where, there was screening. And I don't know more than that. I mean, maybe that regime just isn't realized. I mean, there were certain assumptions that were. Yeah, there was there were regimes where there aren't. Well, in particular, the regime where, which I've talked about. Well, I mean, if you make the noise constant. Anyway, I don't actually understand the calculation well enough, I haven't gone through the details well enough to actually critique why it isn't true. But suffice to say that there are assumptions that were being made, and so, I mean, in a certain sense. Well, I mean, so I'll tell you my worry. I mean, I can give you a load of my worries. I mean, what I would say is, I don't know, what I was taught to say when I was in school was that it's the short wavelength part of this sum. That's what I was taught. I don't exactly know what that means. I have lots of worries about the short wavelength part of the sum. The entire talk has neglected the velocity field, has deleted the velocity field close to the to this point. If it depends on the short wavelength part, then that makes me very nervous. I mean, there are lots of reasons for being nervous. I'm sort of nervous about the argument that there's a Lyapunov function, although I'm not really nervous about that because there is a separation of timescales in the problem. I mean, if I showed you a simulation, of sedimentation, then what you would see is there would be heavy regions and light regions, and they would collide, and there are going to be sort of short wavelength particle rearrangements, and there's some statistics of that. And there must be a way, somebody must know a way to compute the statistics of that. I mean, I know how to formally start to do it, but I just don't, you can just take the difference, you can solve for the noise term, and then you get an integral. So I can do that, but I'm not at all convinced that's the way.
Is it important that the noise is white, or do you need it to have the same value that it would have if you were in equilibrium?
It's not, the calculation we did assumes that the noise is white, but that was just because we wanted to,
is that necessary for
experiments? Absolutely
not.
No, absolutely not. There just has to be. So I don't actually know. I mean, so the question is, how correlated could the noise be? For the experiments to see it flat. And I don't know how far you can push. I just don't know. I mean, this must be an answerable question. I mean, certainly, physically, I just sort of have this picture that, stratification does suppress velocity fluctuations just because of this neutral buoyancy thing. And you do have to continually kick it if you want something to be left. I mean, that is clear. Whether you have to kick it in a white way or in a non-white way, I don't know. Do I know particularly how to think about it? But the nice thing about the system is this is a system where it's really easy to do the experiment. I mean, it's not, these experiments are not rocket science. I mean, there's a particles falling in a box with a stratification, and you can measure the velocity fluctuations. And so, and it's dilute. So one would think, anyway.
Let me ask a simple question about fluctuations. So if you're simulating white,
yeah.
Suppose 10 fluctuations
can
specify
and
Right.
So the way that we did the calculation is that we said, first, suppose there's no stratification. Okay, so in that limit, we know what the answer is, right, for the velocity fluctuations, if they're Poisson distributed, which we at least feel we have evidence for. And we then pick the temperature. There's a ratio of the temperature of the diffusion constant. And we pick that ratio to be such that it agreed with, the answer that we knew. And then when we put in a small stratification, we were basically perturbing about that solution. So.
So what is that temperature?
I don't know, delta V squared.
Is that compared to
anything physical? Well, delta V squared. Is that temperature room temperature? Is it 10 to 12 degrees Kelvin?
Yeah, I should probably know this.
Well, it's in units of delta V squared over m. I mean, in some sense,
m,
that's the unit.
The mass. Yeah. But see, the problem is where there's no inertia.
Well, you might be discovering
still,
that there are inertial
you
terms.
Ah, I don't know that, actually. You're right. That would be an interesting thing. I see. So what you're saying is take the noise amplitude that we use and then shove it together and make a temperature. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. I don't know. That's a good...
And then honestly, you get these goals, you get a sort of two-dimensional layer structure, you can try to model that as extended, and you actually see fluctuations in those goals, and you try to match those fluctuations when you predict the equilibrium extended, you get a temperature about 10 to 12 degrees Celsius. And nobody really knows what the origin of that huge, intensity white noise is to this day, as far as I know. But if you buy that,
I don't know. It's a good question. I simply never thought to compute that number. But I agree. I'll go do it. I never thought to compute it.
I was going to ask a question sort of similar. I mean, if you take those velocity fluctuations, what I was about to suggest is exactly that. That you take the amplitude of the velocity fluctuations, use that as a notion of the thermal perturbation of the particle. That allows you to calculate, if you will, a scale height of the stratification that you would get if that were a real temperature. And then the question is, does that sediment, that scale height...
So wait, you want me to take delta V squared, you want me to take the temperature...
So I'm just saying that this large-scale velocity field is buffeting the particles.
Yes.
Right? If I look at this easily. And that buffeting, of course, gives... If I really were doing a sedimentation problem and asking for the steady state in the end, the steady state is, of course, an exponential given by KT. Right? But if I assume and rather that the scale height you're seeing, the sedimentation scale height, is really just from the fact that there's a buffeting force acting with gravity that gives you a length scale. And then the question is this equilibrium you find just one where that length scale is of order the time, you know, the other length scale in the problem, which is the time you fall in
depth. I suspect that it...
Well, I guess all I'm wondering is, we just would say that the K, you know, in a plasma, you would have a KT here.
Yeah.
You'd have Stokes-Einstein, things would never settle to the bottom, they'd always be, you'd find the equilibrium distribution as an exponential, always.
Right? Yeah.
And all I'm wondering is, if I just take the fact that when you have active sedimentation, you have large-scale velocity fields, and use that as my buffeting force.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
You just map that onto the more familiar problem, where it's temperature.
I mean, the problem is that part of the thing that I get stuck on is it's not a large scale.
There's a large field in the problem.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. I should do this. You're absolutely right. We should do this. We should basically translate everything in terms of the normal terms and in terms of a temperature. And I should have done this before this talk. That would have been helpful. But, you know, still, I guess I would ask, I mean, how do I find out? I mean, you know, my great worry, I'm not even sure this is a worry, it would be interesting, right? If the noise depended on the structure of the particle, like this, you know, these higher order terms in this expansion that I deleted. I mean, you know, just to sort of get you worried too. So if the velocity field, and then I'll shut up, tell me to shut up whenever you want me to shut up. But you know, the velocity field, the approximation for the velocity field that we used is to leading order. So it's basically true, you know, to leading order in the distance that particles are apart. It's a dilute limit velocity field. However, when you throw out all of the higher order terms, the gradient of the velocity field that we're computing with is no longer negative definite, because we threw it all out. All of the dissipation is happening close to the particle. It's all gone. So maybe we're royally screwing up the calculation. I mean, it doesn't seem impossible that we're royally screwing up the calculation, you know, at least in its details. And so, I don't know. We don't think. Maybe.
Experimentally, does it work the other way?
What?
If I do, fluidized bed experiments.
Ah, right. Good. So, right, you could also do fluidized bed experiments, I agree. So you could, namely, what you could do is have an...
fluidized bed equals...
Right, I'm going to tell you. Fluidized bed means that the particles are falling. Wouldn't it be great if the particles weren't falling? So how do you do that? Well, you apply a pressure gradient across the thing so that there's a fluid flow that's going upwards, and then you choose the flow so that basically the particles are sort of at rest in the lab frame. Now the difficulty with that, so Shang is doing, and Paul Chaykin has also done a lot of, there are two difficulties. One is when you do that, you invariably set up a stratification. There's a very strong stratification that's set up simply because the equilibrium of this process, if you think about what is equilibrating the fluidized bed, it's not trivial. I mean, basically, it tends to produce a stratification, number one. Number two, I mean, another thing is that it's not clear it's the same experiment. I mean, after all, when you've applied a pressure gradient, there's this parabolic flow, which didn't exist in this. And I don't know, it seems like something that if one had a reasonable continuum model, one could compute. But on the other hand, it's not obvious that it's the same. But people are doing that. And I mean, maybe that will be. But, you know, these are experiments. I mean, I somehow feel this is a theoretical, the question that I'm asking is a theoretical question. According to the level of detail of the theory that I've presented, it seems to work. There seem to be no contradictions. I mean, maybe, you know, one will be found, but thus far we haven't managed to find one. So, but there's a fundamental theoretical question. I need to know what to say to these people who yell at me about the fluctuation dissipation theory.
When there's no transverse, if you just have a sphere.
Well, I don't know, is there stratification in your star?
So you don't have any boundaries.
Right, so then you see, maybe you'll have a use for this formula, right? You know? And maybe if the formula, if you decide to, of course, the formula has flaws. So I mean, besides the obvious flaws which I've discussed, there's also the fact that this was a monodisperse theory. And you know, it's perfectly reasonable to ask, well, presumably in your star it's not monodisperse, so there are lots of little things to worry about. Although I have the impression, and we've done some tests, although not enough work to say anything about, that this formula is sort of morally, I mean, it's not, you know, the presence of this, in particular, the critical part, which is this, is probably basically right. I mean,
you could do that in a simulation.
Yeah, we could, but actually, you know, until Lars made this comment, actually, Boris told me about this, Lars made this comment, and I never heard it directly from him. You know, we always thought this problem was useless. We were just doing it to entertain ourselves. And so,
well,
you know, if Lars has a reason, for it, then, this is possible. I mean, it's not. It is possible.
Well,
we could do that.
You should do the sphere, right? I mean, you're a theorist, so you should be doing.
No, I'm a theorist, so I want to, I, on the contrary, I would argue that I'm a theorist, and so for that reason, I have to understand the data.
Yes.
Yeah, you know.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's a good point to stop, so thank you.